This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Urban Political podcast. In today's episode, we will be discussing a wonderful recent book, The Suburban Frontier, Middle Class Construction in Dar es Salaam, by Claire Mercer, who is a professor of human geography at the Department of Geography and Environment at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Hello, Claire, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, Mitin. Thank you so much for inviting me and for organizing this. It's great to be here.
So the book is published in 2024 by the University of California Press and is available both in print and as an open access ebook. To discuss the book today, we have two excellent guests with us. Our first speaker, Roger Kyle, is Distinguished Research Professor Emeritus at the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York University in Toronto and a fellow at C4's Humanities Urban Future Program. He researches global suburbanization, urban political ecology, cities and infectious diseases, infrastructure and regional governance. As Roger's work indicates, he's been engaging with global suburbanism for well over a decade now, so he's extremely suited to discuss the book. Hello, Roger, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Nitin. Thanks so very much for having me. And hi, Claire. Hi, Mariam.
Our second guest today, Mariam Guinness, is a PhD student at the University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg. Her work examines the role of private developers in Dar es Salaam. Mariam has previously worked as an assistant research fellow at the Institute of Human Settlement Studies at RD University. Hello, Mariam.
Hi, Nitin. Thanks for having me. And hi, Roger. Hi, Claire.
So thanks for joining the conversation. And perhaps we could start with Roger's reactions to the book. Roger, could you discuss your key takeaways from the book for our listeners? What did you like? What did you perhaps dislike? In what ways is the book unique? How do you read it in the context of your own work on suburbanization? What new did you learn on the topic? And what can our listeners expect when they read this book?
Thank you, Nitin. And thanks, Claire, for writing such a wonderful book. This is a lovely book in every sense of this word. It's well-researched, well-written, unpretentious in style and execution, carefully conceived and designed, full of sparkling theoretical insights and fascinating detailed empirical information. It is also beautiful in that most obvious meaning of lovely, and that starts with a stunning cover and proceeds through its pages in sequences of telling images that make a lot of context in the book. The book is global in theoretical and conceptual reach, continental in geographic expansion, local and in fact regional in empirical scope, and personal in its dialogical style, where the people we meet are always introduced with care and compassion and through the eyes of the committed ethnographer that you are. This is a book that I have long been waiting to read, from when Robin Bloch and Alan Mabin, my friends and co-researchers at Global Suburbanisms, together with their South African colleagues, impressed on the suburban research community almost 20 years ago that Africa had arrived in producing peripheral urbanity that could not be easily lumped in with the informal settlements that dominated the literature to date. A book like The Suburban Frontier was waiting to be written. Of course, there are others too that I don't want to do the name drop game, but Ben Page, Garth Myers, others have worked on these issues for many years. But this is finally a book that sort of puts all this in perspective. But it's also in line with the African urbanism literature often featured on this podcast that has remade urban studies more generally. I'm thinking here predominantly of Philip de Boeck's and Abdelmalek Simon's work on Kinshasa, a city that, as they say, increasingly moves elsewhere, while local land chiefs and modern land markets determine the range of a shifting urban population. Claire helps us further figure out, as Laurent Fourchat has demanded, how African cities, I quote, arrived at their contemporary configurations, end quote. I am thinking here of statements like these. Social classes, as Claire says, are formed over time by conjunctural processes that shape economies, societies and cultures through everyday repetitions of actions. There's always a sense of possibility here, of city building and placemaking, reminiscent of how Simone imagines the city to work, a city of hope, a city of transactions, of interactivities, and so on. In fact, as one of suburban researcher, I think it was Richard Harris, said some time ago, we are missing the suburbanization of the majority urban world because our terminology neatly separates the building of formal subdivisions in the north, especially in the west of the north, from the informal urbanization of the south. This book, Claire's book, helps remedy this problem. This is, to my knowledge, the first book-length in-depth study of African suburbanization and suburbanism that defies the conventional division of suburban studies for the West and North and the study of informal settlements in the South. Specifically, this book fits squarely into a long tradition of suburban research that historically trained its view on the periphery of cities in North America and Australia in particular. Suburban research, suburb studies. It introduces the middle classes as the natural occupants of a certain single-family home-dominated landscape at the margins of expanding urban regions. But the middle classes don't just occupy, they create their homes and socio-spatial environments themselves, not as traditional squatters, not as self-builders, but through steady and cash-based investment into a built environment that is taking shape in and through emerging markets that are themselves embedded in both traditional land governance and modern legal and institutional constructs. I have seen such examples of peripheral middle-classness elsewhere in Africa, especially in the stretch of land between Entebbe and Kampala in Uganda, for example. But also, thanks to Phil Harrison, who took our research group there 2 years ago in Bushbuck Ridge, in eastern South Africa. Those three cases may differ in detail, in origin, in scale, in many other things, but they all signal a turn towards a specific form of urbanization and urbanism that fits, to use the Swahili term from Claire Mercer's book, liberally between the Uswahilini and the Uzungini registers of urban life. That means between the conventionally African and European registers of urbanization in Africa. But I have also seen such landscapes outside of Africa, in Serbia and Turkey, in Hungary, as well as in Latin America. And to some degree, also, Nitin once gave us a wonderful tour outside of Delhi and to look at the majority urban world in various regions of the world through the eyes of this suburban research is, of course, now on the agenda of a lot of people around the world. So one of the most interesting ideas of the book that the book introduces is that of landscape, a term that includes both built environments, natural environments, lifestyles, and intangibles of all kind. Specifically, the book is about how, I quote, formerly peri-urban zone is turned into a desirable suburban landscape, end quote. The term is crucial to understanding the formation of middle-class identities that are built on the apparent order of well-laid-out suburban landscapes, as Claire says. Part of that is the formation of, I quote, property as a disposition and set of practices that has come to characterize middle-class experiences on the suburban frontier, end quote. In fact, Claire says, the liberalization of land was key to middle-class formation, and much more, middle-classness also entailed competence in acquiring relatively high-value unplanned land, end quote. In constructing middle-class suburban landscapes, Dar es Salaam's middle-class builders both profit from and rise above the surrounds that Simone and others see as the substrate of majority urbanism. The landscape is a puzzle of individual houses that are the home of the middle classes. Mercer notes that Dar es Salaam's middle classes are a diverse social group that includes office workers, civil servants, employees in the private sector, and the self-employed, with varying levels of education, income, and assets. What they have in common, Claire says, is the capacity to build and the experience of building Nyumba Nzuri, which means, in English, a comfortable house constructed with permanent materials, some modern convenience, and aesthetic flourishes. There are so many big and small observations that I like about this book, including the idea, for example, that of the restlessness of the city that comes with the insight that the suburban frontier will move on, driven by an indefatigable energy that is typical for the periphery, although it is usually identified with the inner city. Very important point for suburban researchers. Yet it is in the suburban landscape where the energy is most pronounced, full of organizational institutional meaning-making that, like it or not, builds a certain urbanity into previously uninhabited land, at least not inhabited in the way it is now, uncontained, as Claire says, within the legal categories and administrative boundaries defined for it by colonial and post-colonial officials. Yet for these emerging suburbanites, it isn't all about bricks and mortar, and imported versus locally built top-of-the-line windows, for example, which is very important in that context. Where does the stuff come from? How it is being produced? It is also about the imagining and imaging of the city, of urban life, reminiscent of and different from what exists elsewhere, conventional and pioneering. This is specifically an imagination of changing agricultural landscapes as places in which to live. The book brings the suburban conceptual universe to the African periphery, but it doesn't reify the existing ludicrous categories, but keeps them alive as epistemological tools of inquiry. Who said that the private higher hall, English schools, and bars were suburban in the first place? These are well-known and newly emerging, permanently changing indicators of suburbanity and puzzling sides of suburban innovation. As Mercer himself admits in the end, this is only the opening gambit of more intense scrutiny suburban researchers need to bring to the African periphery. But for now, this is a magnificent statement of passionate inquiry into the urban margins of the fastest urbanizing continent on the planet. If I were to leave the author with a question, and I pose it now, which is prompted by her own musings in the conclusion, I would be most interested in knowing a bit more about the material and ideational circuits in which the suburbanity of Dar es Salaam's middle classes is tied up with. Financial markets, fashions, materials, construction norms and aesthetics. Where does China figure in here? And where America? What are the metabolisms of the urban frontier? So thank you very much, Claire. This has been a pleasure to read and a pleasure to comment on. I'm looking forward to further conversation.
Thanks, Oshri. That was extremely insightful. I would like to invite Mariam now. Mariam, what was your reading of the book? You work on Dar es Salaam as well. How does your reading differ or correspond with Claire's reading of Dar es Salaam? How does it advance local urban debates? And what were the things that surprised you in the book? And what further openings could you or perhaps other scholars working on suburban frontiers in Africa and elsewhere take away from the book?
Thanks, Nathan. And thanks, Claire, for giving us such a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it, especially the life stories of the families we talked to. And I really like the domestic architecture and lifestyle sections. I really enjoyed reading those. And I liked how the book is structured. When you're reading it, you go from an intensive read on theories and history and things that you need to focus and put your energy into reading, but then you get to some sort of an easy read with life stories, so it becomes relaxing. I really like that structure. And I also liked that the book provides a detailed ethnographic account of life in Dar es Salaam. Suburbs from extensive fieldwork and interviews and the personal stories of residents and bring the broader themes of class formation, land acquisition, and urban development life. And having worked and lived in Dar es Salaam, I could actually relate and see how the book brought that up. And also, I like how the book situates contemporary suburbanization within the broader historical context of colonialism, socialism, and economic liberalization in Tanzania. And so this perspective helps to explain the persistence of colonial spatial legacies such as the Uzunguni and Uhindini and Uswahilini that the books talk about, and how these influence the emergence of middle class in Dar es Salaam. And I also thought that by focusing on property, which the books talk about in detail, such as land, houses, and landscape as a key driver of middle class formation, the book offers a fresh perspective on urban studies in Africa and hence challenges the dominant narratives that urbanization is driven by industrialization or elite capital, as it highlights the role of everyday investment by the middle class. And we see this very thoroughly within the book. And Another thing that I liked is the book draws on insights from different urban disciplines such as geography, anthropology, and urban studies. So it makes it be very relevant in a wide range of scholars interested in urbanization or class formation in African cities. And if I would say something that I think that maybe I would have loved to see from the book, or maybe area for the research or idea for the next book, if Claire wishes to take on that. So I would have wanted to see what happens to the landowners and the settlers. Where do they move to? I know that the book touches a bit about that and the brief analysis of the impact of increasingly land buying by the middle class to the landowners, who majority of whom are the urban poor. And from the experience, these landowners or the land sellers, they sell land in anticipation of getting money so that they can better their lives. But this is not usually the case. Some of them usually end up in a poverty line. And managing the income that they get from selling the land, it becomes difficult for them. So maybe for the next idea for the next book or ideas for further research, we could explore more deeply how the poor navigate the same suburban frontier, particularly in terms of land access, housing, and livelihood. So yeah, and something else, the book engages with the key theoretical concepts such as the social spatial dialects, coloniality of space. But I think maybe, and you said it clear at the very beginning of the book, that you acknowledge that Dar es Salaam does not fit in the existing theoretical or vernacular ways of thinking about cities. So maybe we could think about what new theoretical frameworks for understanding this suburbanization in African cities can we come up with. Yeah, so I think that was my short review of the book and the thing that I really loved about the book. But generally, it's a nice book. I really recommend it. And I have started to recommend it for my colleagues as well to read it. And I will keep on recommending it because it's such a great read. Thank you, Claire, for giving us that.
Thanks, Mariam. That was really insightful as well. Claire, I would like to invite you next to perhaps pick up on some of the very prescient points that both Roger and Mariam raise in their reading of the book. Additionally, if that's okay, I would like to throw in two small questions. I would love if you could talk about the frontiers aspect of your book as well. How do you position it at what you yourself have called the frontier turn in urban studies? Also, I really like that you made the book available open access. I would be grateful if you could talk about this decision, what it entailed, and how did you negotiate this with the publisher?
Thank you, Nitin. And thank you, Roger and Mariam, for such generous readings of the book. And it's wonderful to be in conversation with you about it. So Roger brings up this fantastic question at the end about the material, the ideational circuits that produce suburbs. You talked about financial markets, you talked about aesthetics, you talked about building materials, ideas. And it's such a great question because there's so much to get into there. For example, you were talking about what's the role of China, what's the role of America. When I first started working on the book in 2012, China was dominant. A lot of furniture was being imported from places like China. And by the time I was finishing the research, and as I continue to go back, there's quite a lot shifting in terms of where people are buying the stuff that they make their houses from and where they get ideas from. People are talking about Turkish doors. People are talking about bringing in materials from the Middle East and particularly from Dubai, increasingly from China as well. The China story has only grown, I think, in the 13 years that I've been working on this. But it's really interesting that the European markets, the North American market, it's not there. It's not particularly important, certainly in terms of building materials. And that's quite interesting. And it struck me, I went to the International Trade Fair in Dar es Salaam last year, and it was the first time I'd been in 20 years. And it's just really interesting how the geography of who's coming to try and trade with Tanzania has completely changed. It's China, it's the Middle East, it's places like Turkey, and the West, if you like, has retreated and increasingly retreating because of what's happening with development aid. So it's a really interesting question about what people are building with and where they get ideas from. Where people get ideas from is fascinating and actually quite difficult to talk to people because people often don't know where they've been inspired. Even if you ask me about my own living room, which is a bit of a mess as I look at it, but it's all of these different ideas that you get from walking around IKEA and looking on social media. And that's exactly what people are doing in Dar es Salaam as well. They're not necessarily walking around IKEA, but they're certainly able to see that kind of aesthetic. And increasingly it's available in the furniture stores, and not just in the large furniture stores where materials are being imported, but increasingly now local artisans who are building furniture are copying those designs. So it's an absolutely fascinating kind of area to think about the materials, the ideas, and how people then curate them in their own houses. And there's much more that one could think about and do with that. The one thing that I'll particularly pick up on, Roger, in your question, you were talking about financial markets. And I guess this also comes to something that Marion was asking about as well, about the kind of broader implications for thinking about African cities from Dar es Salaam. And in the processes of house building and making of urban space that I'm documenting in the book, financial markets are in the background, not particularly important in terms of how people are financing their building projects. People are not financing these houses through mortgage finance. People are building through saving, through using their, if they have salaries. Many people in the middle classes also manage multiple projects, what people call in Swahili miradi, lots of different kind of income streams. And what really struck me about that was that this is an urban landscape that's being predominantly generated through cash and through multiple small cash transactions rather than through more global financialized circuits. And I think, to come to Mariam's question, that is something that's worth thinking about more carefully, I think, because it's not just in Dar es Salaam that this is happening. I'm not saying that African cities are disconnected from global financial markets, absolutely not. And where we started in this conversation, talking about these material ideational circuits, they're important, but I think we also need to recognize how urban space is being produced, partly through financialized urban development. And actually, I'm really interested to hear more about Mariam's research on that. But the urban majority is building through cash, and that produces a different kind of urban space, potentially different politics, as the connections into globalized financial circuits are different rather than absent. I think they're different, and that raises really important questions. And thank you so much for your comments and your questions. And I did just want to pick up on, and Roger mentioned this as well, the kind of tripartite colonial model or enframing of urban space that took place in Dar es Salaam, which is the Uzunguni, Uhindini, and Uswahilini, which for listeners who are unfamiliar with those terms, they reflect racialized urban planning zones, essentially, that began during the German colonial period, but which really took on their own life with British, under the British mandate. They are important because they were a way of thinking about and planning and organizing the city at the beginning of the 20th century. But as I describe in the book, these ways of thinking about the city as different, compartmentalized, different kinds of landscapes where different people and originally different racial groups were expected to live, I was really struck while doing the fieldwork how these ideas resonated in the present. People often refer, middle-class people often refer to parts of the city as Uswahilini, places that they consider to be urban slums or informal settlements that are much more congested, where there's a lack of privacy, where you're less likely to have any kinds of amenities. And so part of what I'm trying to argue in the book is that this tripartite enframing of the city continues to be important in the present, and particularly so for the middle classes who aspire to Uzunguni, to the original kind of European suburb, which was called Uzunguni. But the landscape that they're building doesn't quite approximate that. And I think this is something that both Mariam and Roger picked up really nicely, the idea that Darussalam doesn't quite fit a number of ways of thinking about the city, whether that's, it's not quite the Euro-American suburb, it's not quite divided between Uswahilini and Uzunguni and Uhindini. And that kind of provides, I think, a really fertile place to think from. Why doesn't this place fit? Not to say that I went to Darussalam looking for it to fit external categories, but it does then allow you to think about, okay, so then what is different about African cities? How are they similar and how are they different? And so I'm glad that both of you have picked out that Uswahilini, Uhindini, Uzunguni and framing that's so important, I think. And it also comes to Mariam's question about where do the poor go? Because although the book is about the suburban frontier and it's making a claim that the suburban frontier is where the middle class construct their houses and in the process construct what it means to be middle class, the suburban frontier is not exclusively middle class. There are many poorer urban residents who also acquire land and build houses there. And the urban poor are in the suburb, but increasingly less. And I actually noticed this when I was in Darussalam last month, and indeed walking around Sala Sala for the first time in about 5 years since I'd finished the research for the book. And I was really struck actually at how many more houses there are. There are fewer empty plots as there were when I was originally writing the book. And so I was asking people, who is selling their land and where are they going? And often neighbours don't know. I think, Mariam, you're absolutely right that we need more research on this. What happens to people when they're dispossessed by the market? And it's so difficult to research because once people have left the neighbourhood, it's very difficult to trace where people go. And people would say they sold up, they were offered a large amount of money and they've gone to Bagamoyo, or they've gone to Chalinze, or they've gone to coast region. So they were indicating that people had basically moved out of Darussalam region and had gone to, if you like, the next frontier of suburbanization. But you're absolutely right to bring up that point, Mariam. The urban poor are there in the suburbs. They're also part of placemaking. But I think it seems certainly over the last 13 years or so that it's more difficult for the urban poor to maintain a hold in that landscape. It's not that they choose to be dispossessed by the market, but a lot of people are making that decision. You asked these fantastic questions about the frontier aspect and how do I position the book within the frontier turn in urban studies. I think for me, the frontier was the last part of the title of the book that came to me. The first part, the first word in the title was the middle class. As I was talking to people and the more houses I went into and the more stories I learned about, I was seeing similarities in lifestyles, in what people were building, in how they were living their lives. And so the middle class was the first thing that came to me. The suburb came a little bit later, around the second or third research trip, when I started to have a much better understanding of how this landscape had been produced over time and how it had changed from being essentially a series of rural farms outside of the city and how it had been transformed into this residential neighborhood. And then frontier was the last bit. And as I talked to more and more people about the struggles that they had in accessing land, in holding on to land and securing their land, and the stories that they told about how nothing in the landscape was stable your neighbours couldn't be trusted not to encroach onto your plot. People would pose as brokers and sell a plot multiple times to multiple people. People would invade a plot that had not been adequately secured. And so I really began to get this sense of both the opportunity, but also the risk that was entailed in building in this landscape. And that's partly also why I've stuck with the idea of the middle class, because there's always that risk that you might lose your land, which is obviously also a risk that the urban poor face, but it's not so much something that the elite struggle with. And so there's something very specific about this landscape and the opportunities and the challenges that it throws up that I think is particularly interesting and generative for a kind of middle class social group. The other question you asked about open access, how did I manage to do that and why? To me, it was really important to have the book open access so that it could be read as widely as possible, and particularly across Africa. It is possible to enter into agreements with book publishers that distribute books on the African continent, but there are very few of those, and the books can still be relatively expensive for people to buy. And so I wanted it to be open access. And the University of California Press was great, actually, because they have an open access series, which is called Luminosa. And so when I pitched the book to them, I was upfront and said, I would like it to be in that series. And they were very happy to do that. So I had a really great experience with them.
As you were talking about the suburban frontier in Dar es Salaam, it brought some things to mind from the suburban frontiers of Delhi as well. So I really like Roger's push to think in relation and think in comparison. And do remind me, I have to send you this film, one of these films that's made on, it's from 2006, and it's really on the middle-class suburban frontier around Delhi. And it's about this middle-class family who's like, a lot of land gets invaded. The whole film is around this sort of struggle to uphold property. So I'll please remind me to send it to you. But I just wanted to open up at this point. So Mariam, Roger, just feel to jump in with your questions, comments, disagreements.
Okay. So I don't have a question or more comment. It's just like more of reaction from a response from Claire, and also discussion from and a question from Roger. And Claire, yes, I agree. It's very difficult to trust the landowners and where they go. And I'm also seeing this in my research as well. And yes, market dispossession, in other terms, displacement by money, is increasingly happening, especially in prime areas where investors or middle class is moving into. And these owners are offered huge sums of money. And most of them had never even dreamt of having that kind of money in their entire life. So some would sell because they would feel like they don't belong in these places anymore because another class of people is moving in. But then others would sell because they feel like they can have a better life, especially economically, from the money that they get, because it's very sufficient and significant amount for them. And I would also like to add on the role of the European or Asian market in Tanzania, as Roger mentioned. And currently, there has been a growing trend of people traveling to China and Turkey, mostly to buy building materials, especially those who have the financial capacity to do that. So some builders would travel themselves to China or Turkey or Spain to look for building materials themselves. And also in Dar, there are some number of building material shops selling materials such as tiles and other finishing goods from, and mostly Turkey and Italy and Spain, I think. And it comes from the demand side, from mostly the middle and high income people who prefer what they consider to be quality products. And also they have aspirations of the houses to look like the houses they see, for instance, on Pinterest or IKEA. Like, where do these middle income get their inspirations from? So yes, there's a significant presence of this kind of the movement of materials and people from Asia and Europe as well.
One of the things I was thinking of, and then obviously the whole colonial question is, it's strong in the book, but for me, this has a particular aspect. And I I am originally German, and this was one of the few countries that the Germans once had under colonial rule. And this is a particular form of coloniality with particular awful history and of oppression and violence, particularly in what is today Namibia, where this has just begun to be documented. But on the topic of what we're talking about today, I'm thinking about, in line with what Mariam just raised in terms of the ideas that go back and forth, is that we wouldn't have a bungalow in Los Angeles or in Toronto if the British hadn't colonized India, because this is where the idea came from, or the form of the bungalow came from, which has, of course, been documented in the literature, and how this idea and the item of a bungalow might have moved around the world in these particular ways. And we think in the colonial context, of course, of the exchange of these ideas and how they go back and forth. I don't know whether there is such a history between what I think was called Tanganyika and German Southwest Africa at the time, that the German middle and upper classes, apart from being part of the slaughter of the native population, did they also take up ideas from there? Did they make that part of the cultural history of the Germany in a way? This is one thing I would like to know more about. The book piqued my interest in that, and to what degree some sort of an exchange might have taken place. But this is just a personal reaction to it, and in how colonial history in this book became for me personal history, with a set of questions that I hadn't asked myself before. So it piqued my interest in this particular way. But one way is another point that is interesting to me, and Claire to some degree went into this territory when you said that you had been back for the first time in 5 or 6 years. What I've seen in similar kinds of places, in some of the ones I mentioned in my initial comments, in places like Serbia or in Greece, in other places where you can see rapid change in the urban periphery. And I can say to some degree the same thing about where I grew up in southern Germany, because I grew up on the urban suburban periphery in a self-built house. And my grandfather was a foreman as a mayor. He was all as a stonemason, but he was also the mayor of the village. So he built himself a house, and that became the house in which he and his wife lived, my grandmother, but then also my aunt and her family and my family lived in the same house, and there were three stories on it. And if you go around the world in these peripheral middle class areas, you see that sort of thing, working class and middle class areas. So I'm curious about whether you already see whether these spaces that the middle class built in somewhat in exclusivity, because they built these walls around and they have this idea of a private appearance, and whether they now already begin to have a multi-generational reality, the sons and daughters who grow up building something in the back of this house, or are they putting another story on top, or is that culturally unacceptable? Are the kids expected to move somewhere else, as it is in the north and in the west, with suburbia is so exclusive in North America that the idea of a multi-generational house is completely culturally taboo. It's only now reintroduced to North America by new immigrants who come, newcomers who come to places like Toronto, who now live in multi-generational households in the suburbs. The Anglo populations that produced these suburbs, for them, it was an anathema to live with grandma and grandpa in the same house. So the question here is this new suburbia that you're looking at also perhaps giving us new forms of multi-generational living, or how does this type of modernity that is often being described as the family becomes smaller and more nuclear, is this also now taking roots in this suburbia? What can you tell us about that? Or is it too early to even think about those things?
Wow, what great questions. Okay, before I forget, Roger, on the question of German colonialism, I've just finished reading a book by the Tanzanian author Abdulrazak Gurnah, which is called Afterlives. And it's brilliant because it's set in the context of German colonialism, and one of the characters caught up in the war. And it's a really fascinating insight into a period of history which I actually don't know a great deal about, apart from the secondary material that I read for the book. And I think that on the question of German colonialism, the one thing that I would say that is super important for the contemporary period is about land tenure and the fact that the German colonialists alienated land in Tanganyika. And in a sense, that has never changed because land in Tanzania continues to be held, it's vested in the president on behalf of the people. So there's a kind of long continuity. The book is most concerned with the British period because that's where you have so much more of the kind of urban planning, the extension of the kind of bifurcation of land. Under the Germans, all land was alienated, but freehold was allowed in the cities and in the most productive agricultural areas. And it was freehold was mostly held by Germans, by Arabs and other European settlers. Under British colonialism, that what Mahmud Mamdani calls the bifurcation of land is expanded, so that when we look at the history of Dar es Salaam, the place that I'm writing about was in a customary area, it was a rural area, the land was governed by a native authority. Why that's relevant to what's happening today is because it both allows the lack of clear land rights on the suburban frontier, both provides the opportunities for people to buy and sell land now in the market, often without land titles or with kind of quasi customary titles that might be overseen by neighbours or a local government official, while also kind of coming back to that question about why frontier, it also, the lack of land rights means that people are never really secure unless you get a land title from the government, which, as I document in the book, is incredibly bureaucratically complicated and long-winded and expensive. So most people on this middle-class suburban frontier actually don't have title to their land. And you know, the point I'm trying to make is that we can trace that all the way back through to the German period, and then it was expanded under the British. But I strongly recommend that book by Abdulrazak Gurnabi. It's absolutely fantastic. The question about rapidity and the rapidity of change on the urban periphery, and your question about multi-generational living in these landscapes, that's such a fascinating question. And where you finished up with that, Roger, when you said, actually, is it too early to tell? It is a little bit, because many of the people who've built houses that I'm talking to have in their kind of 30s, in their 40s, their children are young. So I think that's an open question. What I can say is that the people that I've been talking to are already thinking about this question. And what they're doing is trying to buy other plots of land, often beyond where they've already built, because it's cheaper to buy further out. So people are already anticipating what they might give to their children as inheritance. Or indeed, people are also anticipating areas of the city that they think are going to develop in the future and where it would be good for them to have a foothold in the city at that point. So people are definitely thinking about the next generation, and they are thinking in terms of assets and wealth. But exactly what that will look like is unclear at the moment. Certainly, I don't think people are building up. I think that at the moment, you would have a two-story house, and it would be unlikely that then your children would build up, as you see in some other parts of the world. But certainly some members of families they're dividing their own land and saying, okay, this is your land now, so you can build there, or I've got this plot further out that you'll be able to build on in the future. So there's definitely things that people are doing and thinking about in order to be able to pass on assets to their children. And in fact, that's one of the arguments that I try and make in the book about how the middle class is both formed and reproduced, that property is absolutely central to that. And the middle classes have been really at the forefront of being able to carve up this formerly rural hinterland, not just for themselves, but also to anticipate what they might need in the future. And Marion, I just wanted to agree with your comment about market displacement. And you're absolutely right. People sell because they're being offered sums of money that they could never have imagined being offered in their lifetimes. And it's something that I want to think about a little bit more, because I don't really talk about this in the book, but I've been talking to people who are further out on the edge of the city. And when you ask them, why did you come to build here? People will say, why wouldn't I? I was offered so much money. I could buy a larger plot of land and I could build a better house than what I had closer to the city. Why wouldn't I? And so I'm really glad that you brought that point up. I think it's really important. And I think that requires us to think about our concepts around displacement and dispossession and gentrification. Yeah, there's something there that I want to think with. So thank you for bringing that up. I think it's really important.
Thanks, everyone. Mariam, do you want to go in with a question or a comment, perhaps?
It's just some additional comments that, yeah, Roger and Nessa's comment. I was just thinking about the question on colonialism and colonial footprints and if they exist. And I think it's funny because in Tanzania, we don't really talk much about colonialism, but I think the colonial footprints, they still exist and people practice them, I guess, subconsciously or maybe even consciously, depending on what issues were viewed as superior or inferior during the colonial period, especially in terms of settlement segregation that happened in the past. If you look at the settlement growth pattern in Dar es Salaam right now, it literally follows the settlement segregation by the Germans and British. So the areas which were categorized for Europeans and for the Indians and the Swahili people, the settlement growth pattern still follows that same segregation. But I don't think it's because it happens because of colonialism, but it's just that, yes, that was the root cause of it, but now people just practice it because that's what they know. And these areas that were considered superior then, they're still considered superior now. And for the middle class and the high income people, they wouldn't want to stay in the areas which were considered inferior, such as the native places for the Swahili people. And also, I wanted to say something else. Yeah, something about an issue of whether we see the dynamics in terms of whether people live with their grandparents or their children, or if parents would want children to move out of the house at some point. But something else to also think about, and I agree with you, Claire, I think it's just now that people are starting to think about those things. And it's because majority of the population in there are migrants from other regions, and they came in search of opportunities. So the parents would have remained in the rural areas. And these people, if they succeed, they would build houses for their parents where they come from. But it's the middle class that is emerging right now. So from the youth, so to say, who came in Dar es Salaam maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and they have established themselves, they have families in Dar es Salaam right now. So they would think about having their own place for the families, that they would also think about what happens after I'm gone or what happens in the future. So these people would also want to buy properties and land in other places as well for themselves, but also to live as inheritance for their kids. So it's true what you're saying. It's something that if you talk to people now, they're thinking about that. But yeah, it's also because most of them are immigrants, and yeah, they would build houses for their parents where they come from. Majority of them will do that.
Thanks, Mariam. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I want to come back to what you were just saying about, it's really interesting listening to you reflect on this. And when you said, you know, we don't talk much about colonialism, and perhaps people practice some kind of afterlives of colonialism, perhaps subconsciously. And you talked about segregation. I think you're absolutely right. And in the book, I try to describe this through what I'm calling the coloniality of space, which is both the kind of legacy around land tenure that we were just talking about in relation to German and British colonialism, but it's also a kind of aesthetic politics around what kind of landscape people think is desirable and therefore where they would want to live. And that landscape is also something that's colonially inflected. I mean, Roger, talking about the bungalow and how important that is as a kind of aesthetic and architectural form, I think also landscape is a really important aesthetic and architectural form that people are reproducing in the way that they produce urban space. And so I use this term, the coloniality of space, to try and capture the way in which people, either consciously or subconsciously, are reproducing these inequalities in the built environment that can be traced back to colonialism, but which are not necessarily path dependent on that. You know, there's always kind of possibilities for space being made otherwise.
Thanks a lot. I was thinking in relation to Athens, a city my partner comes from, and we spend a lot of time in Athens as well, and how it is also shaped by inheritance. You know, I was seeing a lot of similarity in how cities come about in majority world through these ideas of inheritance. So I'm really glad that you, Mariam, Claire, Roger, you also brought that perspective in. So thanks, Claire. Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Mariam. This was a splendid conversation. I really enjoyed it. And I'm sure that the listeners enjoyed it too. If the listeners have any comments on things we discussed in today's podcast or about Claire's book, please do write to us at urbanpolitical@pronturnmail.com. And in case you like the podcast, please share it with your friends and colleagues, and please consider following us on Blue Sky, LinkedIn, and Instagram for future episodes. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Nitin and Roger and Marianne.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Nitin. It was a pleasure. Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Claire.
It's fantastic to have this conversation, and I hope we can continue it.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigee.io.